Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 13th day of February, 2021. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and let's start off our look at the week that was this way this evening. Does anybody really believe that occupied communist America isn't truly insane at this point? And, of course, they're already talking about complete gun confiscation. It says, if you're not insane, we're not going to let you have a gun anyway. How do we know you're insane? The fact that you can read the Constitution and would want one of those things is enough. In any case, let's start off today with this little story just to kind of set the stage. No masks. One mask. Two masks. No. Fauci backtracks. So does the CDC. Now they're officially saying you should wear two masks. Twice as much a slave. I already told the coyote ugly joke, in case one mask falls off, and this certainly isn't funny either. Unless you think I'm joking, and this is yet another story from the Babylon Bee that has come true, just 1 week after America's Dr. Mengele, Tony Fauci, said, quote, there's no data that indicates it, meaning double masking, is going to make a difference, unquote. But since when has lack of data or testing made the least bit of difference? Starting Wednesday, the Coercive Death Council, or CDC, has now begun officially recommending that Americans wear two masks, specifically a cloth mask over a medical mask to slow the spread of the booga booga flu. Because, you know, science. They don't say what would have once been obvious. If you have a beard, it doesn't make any difference at all. And they also don't say, oh yeah, and if you keel over from asphyxiation, don't blame us. And the same goes for other mask-borne diseases, from maskne to bacterial pneumonia. From there, let's start back at the beginning, over the weekend, with what should have been the biggest news of the week, ignoring the spin, of course, and that ought to be causing major investigations in that disgustingly dumbed-down building, and arguably a real impeachment for real high crimes and misdemeanors, don't hold your breath, was an after-the-fact admission by none other than Time magazine. I guess since they got away with it, they're now able to rub people's noses in it. Some are calling it self-indicting, but it's really self-congratulatory. Ha ha, look what we can do to a formerly free republic. And they won't even use that word anymore. A Communist Party hack, Time magazine actually calls her their political writer. She also turns out to be a biographer for Speaker of the Traitors, Nancy Pelosi, wrote these words in the February 15th, 2021 issue of Time magazine, just recently out. Quote, there was a conspiracy unfolding behind the scenes, one that both curtailed the protest and coordinated the resistance from CEOs. Those surprises, she admitted, were the result of an informal alliance, some would call it a conspiracy in this case because it's real, between left-wing activists and business titans. The pact was formalized in a terse, little-noticed, yet deliberately ignored, up until now at least, joint statement of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and AFL-CIO, published, when else, on Election Day. Both sides would come to see it as sort of an implicit bargain, she said, inspired by the summer's massive, sometimes destructive, racial justice protests, in which the forces of labor came together with the forces of capital to, what, undermine the republic? No, they won't say it that way still. She says, to keep the peace and oppose Trump's assault on democracy. But here's the real hubris, folks. Listen carefully to this whopper. Quote, the handshake between business and labor was just one component of a vast cross-partisan campaign to protect the election. Yeah, to protect the fraud that they already had bought and paid for. An extraordinary shadow effort, she admits, dedicated not to winning the vote, no, to rigging the vote, no, but to ensuring it would be, and I kid you not, she actually has the chutzpah to say this, ensuring it would be free and fair, credible, and uncorrupted.
That's my story. Oh, that's my story. My story, and I'm sticking to it.
Unquote. How did this massive conspiracy to undermine a free and fair and, yes, credible election work? Quote,
They got states to change voting systems and laws and help secure hundreds of millions in public and private funding. Yep, there's your deadly fascist partnership, folks. They successfully pressured social, she left out the word ist, media companies to take a harder line against, disinformation and use data-driven strategies to fight viral smears. This, she wrote, is the inside story of the, what, she actually admits it, conspiracy to save the 2020 election based on access to the group's inner workings, never-before-seen documents, and interviews with dozens of those involved from across the political spectrum, from far, far left to far left, folks, and of course those that masquerade as rhinos, too. Quote, it is the story of an unprecedented, creative, and determined campaign whose success also reveals how close the nation came to disaster. Yes, but for the work of these people to complete the revolution and undermine what's left of free and fair and credible elections, actual Americans may have actually gotten an honest vote and staved off, well, what's happening now? There's a quote in here that ought to be underlined and in bold, too. Ian Basson, co-founder of Project Democracy, it says, a nonpartisan rule of law advocacy group. Good grief, what a whopper. Quote, every attempt to interfere with the proper outcome of the election was defeated. Unquote. And this part almost sounds like an admission. Get this. He continues, but it's massively important for the country to understand that it didn't happen accidentally. No, all those votes didn't show up at 3 a.m. by accident. We pretty much already knew that. The system, he said, didn't work magically. Democracy is not self-executing, unquote. No, they executed it. They had to put a bullet through its head and a wooden stake in its heart. And yes, admits Molly Ball, quote, that's why the participants want the secret history of the 2020 election told. Yeah, now that they've gotten away with it. Even though it sounds like a paranoid fever dream, a well-funded cabal of powerful people ranging across industries and ideologies. Ah, come on. Working together behind the scenes to influence perceptions, change rules and laws, alter media coverage, and control the flow of information. They were not rigging the election, and here's the money quote, they were fortifying it. Fortifying it, yeah, against the will of the actual people and the Electoral College and a whole bunch of other things that are now pretty well dead letters, like the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. The article even goes on to cite some of the traitors, foreign and domestic, who were funding it. Private philanthropy, it says, stepped into the breach. An assortment of foundations contributed tens of millions in election administration funding. No surprise, though, they didn't come completely clean. The word China, for example, doesn't appear in the article. Neither do the words Smartmatic or Dominion, or for that matter, even vote rigging or vote swapping. So they're not telling the whole truth yet. Maybe they still knew they'd be banned by Twitter and Facebook if they tried. This admission, though, did slip in. In November 2019, quote, Mark Zuckerberg invited 9 civil rights leaders, sick, to dinner at his home, where they warned him about the dangers of the election-related falsehoods that were already spreading unchecked. It took pushing, urging, conversations, brainstorming, all of that to get to a place where we ended up with more rigorous rules and enforcement, unquote, says Vanita Gupta, president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, who attended the dinner and also met with Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey and others. And at least Time admits this in a parenthetical insertion here. Gupta has been nominated for Associate Attorney General by who else? The senile marionette in chief himself. There's more here about how they use things like the so-called Voting Rights Lab and Into Action that created state-specific memes and graphics and spread these things by email that obviously didn't get banned, as well as Twitter, too, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, urging that, say it with me, folks, every vote, except those that we don't want to count, be counted. And if they didn't win, the group's now-defunct website had a map listing 400 planned post-election riots, or no, they say demonstrations, to be activated via text message as soon as the day after November 4th, in order to stop the coup that they feared. Gotta say sick after that now, don't we? Because it would have been a counter-coup at this point. Yes, it says, the left was ready to flood the streets. And you know darn well that wouldn't have been called an insurrection now, don't you? How does this bit of conspiracy theory confirmation end? You can almost guess, can't you? Democracy won in the end. And I'm not even going to read some of the crap that's in this final paragraph. All I'll say is the will of the people, folks, doesn't mean squat anymore, because the people have been dumbed down, muzzled, and now gagged. But, says the author, in retrospect, this is what it took to put an end to elections in the United States of America. Oh, wait a second. No, it says this is what it took to put on, put on an election in the United Soviet States of America. Do we really have to talk about this next bit of America gone insane? I'll try to make it as brief as possible, folks. America's traitorous number one rhino, Senate Minority Leader, sick, Mitch McConnell is signaling to what's left of the Republican Party that their final vote on Donald Trump's impeachment is a matter of conscience. Yeah, they put their hand on a Bible and lie, so why not? And the senators who disputed the constitutionality of this idiotic farce, a.k.a. the trial, could still vote to convict the former president anyway, according to three people that claim to be familiar with his thinking, says Bloomberg, or lack thereof, says your host. The Tennessee rhino also said he hasn't made up his own mind about how he'll vote, or maybe the right puppet string hasn't been pulled yet, even though he voted on Tuesday to declare that it was unconstitutional for the Senate to hear a case against a former president.
Are you crazy? Or just plain stupid?
Stupid is stupid does, Mrs. Blue.
I guess
so, too. And the U.S. Congress deserves to be the laughingstock, come to think of it, along with the White House, of the entire world. Given that the very same people who've been trying so hard to foment an outright civil war for several years now are claiming the president, how dare he, used fighting words, that it's a little bit like a bad movie where Jeffrey Dahmer and Jack the Ripper pretend to try Little Orphan Annie for tweeting about violence. Constitutional law professor Jonathan Turley wrote that reckless rhetoric, as he put it, is in fact a reckless standard for what now passes for an impeachment trial. He notes that the Democrats are treading on thin ice when they pick some of the very same people to prosecute this bogus case that have been guilty of at least as bad language in the past, including Jimmy Raskin, Democrat from Maryland, the lead impeachment manager, who was chided for using the words, quote, fight like hell, in an interview in 2019 with The Atlantic. The very words they repeatedly replay from Trump. He also used that phrase repeatedly in the years prior to that, while urging his supporters to fight for Democrat control of Congress. And who can forget Eric Swalwell, notorious, says Turley, for his inflammatory rhetoric. He even made mocking threats against Susan Collins. How dare she worry about sexual assault? And this, of course, is the guy who threatened to nuke gun owners, too. There's a problem, says Turley, with a strategy that seems focused not on proving incitement of an actual insurrection, but some ill-defined form of political negligence. Congress, he writes, could end up looking like the unimpeached co-conspirator here because of all the stupid things they've been saying for so long that really are far worse than anything the president said. And he gives a list. Representative Maxine Waters called on people to confront Republicans in public, and that's putting it kindly. Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts insisted during the violent protests in 2020 that, quote, there needs to be unrest in the streets, unquote. Then there's Kamala Harris herself. Miss Heels in the Air, who said protesters should, quote, not let up, even as those protests turn violent and deadly. Nutcase Nancy Pelosi, too, the speaker for the traitors, he quotes, who condemned fellow House members as the enemy within. And in the midst of last year's violent protest, she was criticized for saying, quote, I just don't know why there aren't uprisings all over the country. Maybe there will be, unquote. Chuckie Schumer stood in front of the Supreme Court, citing two justices by name and declaring menacingly, quote, hey, Gorsuch, hey, Kavanaugh, you've unleashed a whirlwind, and you're going to pay the price, unquote. And there's a whole lot more here, up to and including fired FBI director, the Whoremeister himself, James Comey, who recently said the Republican Party needs to be burned down. It's just not a healthy political organization. Unquote. The fact is, concludes Turley, politicians, pundits, and professors, and he quoted a whole bunch of the latter as well, regularly engaged in far more direct, violent speech than what Trump said on January the 6th. The question is whether we want shifting majorities to decide whether a statement is insightful, meaning full of insight, or insightful with a C, a dangerously fluid standard. Well, let me put it this way, folks. Turns out what we're dealing with here is not a standard at all. It's a bludgeon. So after reading that, I guess I would suggest a compromise for the Senate they ought to consider. It would certainly at least unify Americans. That is, get rid of every scumbag in the House, the Senate, and certainly the White House who ever said anything that amounts to fighting words. And then while we're at it, do it at the New York Times, the WAPO, NPR, CNN, and all the other major public-private news agencies. Keep on going with the bureaucracy, especially the FBI, IRS, ATF, DEA, DHS, TSA, NSA. Let's not forget SS and NKVD, DIA and ABCDEFG while we're at it. It might save 100 million or so American lives in the years to come. We follow that up with some really insightful comments from Dr. Mark Sirkis at drsirkis.com via Lou Rockwell and other places, who notes that counting and caring for the dead really helps to reveal the depth of the deception here too. COVID, he begins, is as much a media disease as it is a viral disease. It's also a health official disease more than a killer viral infection. Because even without a vaccine, without proper treatment, the vast majority of booga 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 COVID-19 84 deaths have comorbidities, usually at least two. And to put it mildly, it's a matter of debate in most deaths that are counted as COVID what in reality killed the patient. The most disgusting thing, though, about this entire plandemic story is that the press and the medical establishment hid proper treatments for COVID and other viral infections. We know why, folks. That's so they could get emergency warp speed approval for untested vaccines. From the beginning, says Dr. Sirkis, they sold the story that only vaccines could save the world, when most doctors know at this point that's simply not true. People are dying from many causes, and often from several simultaneously. The human race is sick, physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, and it certainly shows up in our seriously demented leadership and chronic disease and death statistics. What's more, all of this was true before COVID. Medical scientists, he says, have been trying to speed and refine their understanding of the disease. However, in this quest, they're hamstrung, entirely so, by their refusal to acknowledge a number of important things, like nutritional deficiencies, toxicities, and emotional stress that are also fundamental causes of disease. None of these causes can be touched with pharmaceutical medicines, nor with gene therapies. And worse, pharmaceutical approaches tend to amplify these causes. Drugs make nutritional deficiencies worse, and they increase the body's toxic burdens while driving up emotional and mental stress with their incessant denial of the very real human factors. He goes on to describe the background to various COVID syndrome disorders, including things like alcohol consumption, which is at an all-time high, creating deficiencies in zinc, vitamin A, magnesium, and vitamin B1 in the body. More smoking and drugs, obviously, given the lockdowns and the booga-booga fears. Intake of carbs, bread, rice, pasta, cereal, all of which impair absorption of vitamin B1. There's sleep loss, increased fear, stress, anxiety, depression, and PTSD, as well as increased severity of things like diabetes and increased exposure to all kinds of electromagnetic pollution. Think 5G rollout. Also, your host can't help but note, done at warp speed, using work at home due to the booga booga flu as the excuse. Where millimeter wavelengths clearly have effects on the body, that for the most part, Big Brother and his bought and paid for science aren't about to let you know. And finally, there's decreased oxygen intake, given the mandated mask, which is clearly not good, and increased rebreathing of CO2, which is also not good. Moreover, he continues, masks are causing gum disease and thus systemic inflammation. According to new research published in the Journal of Clinical Periodontology, patients with gum disease are 9 times more likely to die from COVID, says the official publication of the European Federation of Periodontology, or EFP. A study of more than 500 patients found that those with gum disease were 3.5 times more likely to be admitted to intensive care and 4.5 times more likely to need a ventilator. Of course, there are big bucks associated with Big Brother's subsidy of all of those wonderful outcomes. Said Professor Lior Shapira, president-elect of the EFP, the results of the study suggest that the inflammation in the oral cavity may open the door to the coronavirus becoming more violent. Oral care should be part of the health recommendations to reduce the risk for severe COVID-19 outcomes. And furthermore, notes Dr. Sirkis, the suffocation of humanity with masks needs to stop immediately, since dentists in New York report that half of their formerly healthy patients, now wearing masks, show severe gum disease. Bottom line, he suggests, there are so many ways that health officials are hurting people. During the COVID-1984 pandemic, health officers have taken pharmaceutical and medical terrorism to entirely new levels. The harm they're doing is on a scale never before seen. They're ripping apart societies, families, cultural norms, suffocating humanity with masks, and abusing a whole generation of children by keeping them out of whatever value school once had. The verdict is clear. The imposition of lockdowns and social distancing, along with delays in getting children and adolescents back into schools, have been fatal for society, creating a slow-motion mental health explosion that could last for decades. From there, he goes to David Beasley, executive director of the UN World Food Program, who highlighted one of the many great harms being done by informing us that the number of people now on the brink of starvation globally has doubled. From 135 million to 270 million, not just due to COVID-1984, but due to the medical response to it. Climate change, in spite of the scientific illiteracy and fog that surrounds it, is also causing growing seasons to get shorter as the weather gets colder. Interesting, isn't it, folks? They've been saying the opposite for so long, now they're quietly admitting, oh yeah, yeah, it's doing exactly what we said wouldn't happen, but still, be afraid, be very afraid. Today, says Dr. Sirkis, the real humanitarian crisis is not economics, politics, or related aggressions, even though those issues may threaten to gut us. It's the crisis of human health across the full spectrum of human existence. Under the care, and you ought to put it in quotes, of modern medicine and psychiatry, the human race has now never been sicker. And yes, while COVID death counts may be a red herring, vaccine deaths are not. The CDC has done another data dump into the VAERS, or Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which tracks, basically covers up, and indemnifies injuries and deaths caused by vaccines. And the data through January the 29th of 2021 shows 11,249 recorded adverse events, including 501 deaths, immediately following injections of the experimental COVID mRNA shots by both Pfizer and Moderna. And that, of course, is data for just the United States alone, although vaccine deaths are being reported worldwide, and all of this is being censored by the Waystream Press and the digital giants who only want us to read what WHO wants us to see. And let's not forget, folks, we haven't even begun to see long-term effects yet. Dr. Sirkis makes a couple of other interesting observations as well, like things that we're not seeing or not getting booga-booga-boogaed about. Remember when hospitals in 2017-2018, during the influenza epidemic, were sending people to urgent care centers in every state? Medical facilities were responding with extraordinary measures, asking staff to work overtime, setting up triage tents, restricting friends and family visits, even canceling elective surgeries? Well, I didn't hear in 2020, he says, that anyone was being treated in tents. And we have videos from all over the world of empty hospitals. Indeed, when the panic in New York City was at its height and the Fed sent in a hospital ship, it was a COVID ghost ship because almost no patients were actually treated there. Instead, they pulled off the pandemic by intense, nonstop media reporting and reassigning other disease deaths as COVID, which is why influenza deaths went to zero, and doctors were told to fill out death certificates with the cause of death as COVID-19, whether it was or not. And it doesn't hurt that hospitals and states got big bucks as a result. Furthermore, he continues, when was the last time you heard mention of the millions of people who died of cancer or heart disease? During the time 2 million allegedly died of the booga booga flu, 9 million died of cancer. What about their names and faces? Or the 50,000 who will die from cardiovascular diseases today? Well, most of those will be called COVID, your host interjects, so why worry about it? There were 18 million, though, of these over the past year. Did we stop the buses for them? And it's not just COVID and similar big deals. There are things like COPD deaths. And let's not forget, lung disease, too, kills millions every year.
The Booga Booga Flu, the overreaction to it, was never about health. It's about control. And we'll pick it up there when we get back.
When I think back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all. And my lack of education hasn't hurt me none. I can read the writing on the wall. Cold or thrown.
Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and want to continue this one on a similar theme, courtesy of a piece written this week by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And before I begin, I need to note one other thing as well. Shortly after penning this piece, he was punished by Big Brother's minions and banned from Instagram, owned by Two Facebook, surprisingly, maybe not, after the WAPO 2 lobbied Two Facebook to take action against him. At least, though, RFK Jr. is no stranger to similar controversy. Certainly, he's well known for trying to disseminate the truth about various vaccines and their effects. And in this case, also a fella who's well known, of course, as the son of Robert F. Kennedy. And no doubt about it, there's quite a bit in this story that reflects a somewhat leftward lean. Still, though, I really appreciate the wealth of information he brings to the table, and the title tells you exactly where it's headed. Bill Gates, he says, in neo-feudalism. A closer look at Farmer Bill, who he notes has quietly made himself the largest owner of farmland in the United States. And for a man that's obsessed with monopoly control, the opportunity to also dominate food production must seem irresistible. According to the latest issue of the Land Report, he begins, Gates has quietly made himself the largest owner of farmland in the United States, with a portfolio that now comprises almost 250,000 acres, 242,000, but it's probably reached 250,000 by now anyway, of American farmland and nearly 27,000 acres of other land across Louisiana, Arkansas, Nebraska, Arizona, Florida, Washington, and at least 18 other states. RFK Jr. notes that Thomas Jefferson believed the success of America's exemplary struggle to supplant the yoke of European feudalism with that noble experiment in self-governance depended on the perpetual control of the nation's land base by tens of thousands of independent farmers, each with a stake in our nation. So at best, Gates' campaign to scarf up America's agricultural real estate is a signal that feudalism, and by the way, folks, there are plenty of other signals, may again be in humanity's immediate future. At worst, though, his buying spree is a harbinger of something far more alarming, says RFK Jr., the control of global food supplies by a power-hungry megalomaniac with a Napoleon complex. So he says, let's explore the context of Gates' stealth purchases as part of his long-term strategy of mastery over agriculture, and in particular, food production, globally. Beginning in 1994, Bill Gates launched what he calls an international biopiracy campaign to achieve vertically integrated dominion over global agricultural production. And that empire now includes vast agricultural lands, hefty investments in things like GMO'd crops, seed patents, synthetic foods, and artificial intelligence, including robotic farm workers, as well as commanding positions in all of the big food behemoths, including Coca-Cola, Unilever, Philip Morris, and with that, Kraft and General Foods, Kellogg's, Procter & Gamble, and Amazon, which of course owns Whole Foods, as well as multinationals like Monsanto and Bayer, which now owns them, that market chemical pesticides and petrochemical fertilizers. And as usual, Gates coordinates all these personal investments using taxpayer-subsidized grants from, what else, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the richest and most powerful organization in all of international aid, as well as his financial partnerships with Big Ag, Big Pharma, Big Chemical, and Big Food, all of which, especially combined, have awesome powers to create captive markets for his products. And characteristically, Gates' approach to global problems put his technology and his chemical, pharmaceutical, and oil industry partners at the center of every solution. Remember, he notes that Gates' innovative strategy for food production was to force America's failed system of GMO, chemical, and fossil fuel-based agriculture on poor African farmers.
and in a ruthless reinvention of colonialism, Gates spent almost $5 billion to dismantle the African farm structure and replace it with a highly corporatized and industrialized agriculture, chemically dependent monocultures, extreme centralization, and top-down control. And in the process, he forced small African farms to transition to imported commercial seeds, petroleum fertilizers, and pesticides. And then he built a supply chain infrastructure for chemicals and seeds and pressured various African governments to spend huge sums on subsidies and used draconian penalties and authoritarian control to force farmers there to buy his expensive inputs and comply with his diktats. He made farmers replace traditional nutritious subsistence crops like sorghum, millet, sweet potato, and cassava with high-yield industrial crops like soy and corn, two of the most pervasive GMO crops in the world. And in the process, he enriched the commodities traders, but left poor Africans with little to eat. While nutrition and productivity plummeted, and soils grew more acidic with every application of petrochemical fertilizers. As with Gates' African vaccine enterprise, there was neither internal evaluation nor public accountability. A 2020 study that RFK Jr. quotes entitled False Promises, the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, AGRA, is the report card on Gates' cartel and their 14-year effort, which concludes that the number of Africans suffering extreme hunger has now increased by 30% in the 18 countries he targeted. In the process, rural poverty metastasized dramatically, and the number of hungry people in those nations has risen to 131 million. And under Gates' new plantation system, Africa's rural populations have now become slaves on their own land. Those that aren't being killed outright, though, like in South Africa. And the tyrannical serfdom of high-tech inputs, mechanization, rigid schedules, burdensome conditionalities, credits, and subsidies are defining features of Bill Gates' version of the so-called Green Revolution. Matter of fact, the only entities benefiting from Gates' program, says RFK Jr., are his international corporate partners, particularly, of course, Monsanto, in which Gates made major investments. And in the process, Gates himself even filmed commercials for Monsanto's GMOs, touting them as the solution to world hunger. And here he quotes Heather Day, AgriWatch spokesperson, who says, the Gates Foundation and Agra claim to be pro-farmer, pro-poor, and pro-environment, but their approach is closely aligned with transnational corporations like Monsanto and foreign policy actors like USAID, the so-called United States Agency for International Development. They take advantage of food and global climate crises to promote high-tech, centralized industrial agriculture that generates profits for Gates' corporate partners while degrading the environment and disempowering individual farmers. Their programs are a dark form of philanthrocapitalism based on corporate biopiracy. But to cloak his dystopian plans for humanity as benign, Gates has expropriated the rhetoric of, oh, you've heard these words, sustainability, biodiversity, good stewardship, and of course, climate. And while these might be grim realities, suggests the left-leaning RFK, requiring urgent attention, Gates' record exposes his benevolent intentions as masquerades for his personal agenda to maximize profit and control. And he goes on to note how it's baffling to him how so many of his friends in the environmental movement have swallowed Gates' chicanery. And maybe it's no surprise that especially the gullible leftists are buying into all of this. Still, though, says RFK Jr., what he calls the leading climate groups, like the National Resources Defense Council, Environmental Defense Fund, the Sierra Club, Greenpeace, and etc., receive virtually nothing from the world's largest philanthropy. His investment history instead suggests that the climate crisis, at least when it comes to Gates and his cronies, is no more than an alibi for intrusive social, I'm going to put the word ist on there, socialist control, and of course, the Great Reset and the associated surveillance, massive science fiction geoengineering boondoggles, including his demanded and terrifying projects to spray the stratosphere with calcium chloride or seawater, allegedly to slow warming, to deploy giant balloons to saturate the atmosphere with reflective particles to blot out the sun, or his perilous gambit, as RFK Jr. puts it, of releasing millions of genetically modified mosquitoes in South Florida. When we place these nightmare schemes in context alongside the battery of experimental vaccines he's already forcing on 161 million African children every year, it's pretty clear Gates regards all of us as his lab rats. He's also heeded Henry Kissinger's infamous advice, control oil and you control nations, and his energy holdings nowhere reflect his expressed antipathy for greenhouse gases. He owns major stakes in all kinds of hydrocarbon producers like Exxon, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, and Shell. He owns the world's largest private jet company, and he's even involved in coal. Yeah, says RFK, Gates is betting on the future of carbon. And furthermore, his chemical, industrial, agriculture enterprises are the antithesis of climate-friendly. His GMO corn requires heavy applications of fertilizers, pesticides, agrochemicals made from natural gas and other fossil fuels, and he's effectively forced Africans, in the words of Michael Pollan, to eat oil. And African farmers even call Gates' program, quote, climate-stupid agriculture. Yep, says RFK Jr., he's learned to fatten himself on global crises, whether it's pandemics, climate, famine, or mass extinction. Climate change, though, has given Gates an excuse to create monopolies over seed, food, and agriculture. And that, folks, is the key here. He goes into a whole lot of detail. I'm going to skip some of the specifics. Literally, there's page after page of them here, but we'll at least hit some of the highlights. In 2008, he says, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation announced $306 million in grants to promote high-yield, sustainable agriculture among smallholder farms in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. Trouble was, climate change turned out to be the guise for more mischievous geoengineering. And meanwhile, he says, Gates' ag policies are destroying our planet's climate systems, pushing millions of species to extinction, desertifying the soil, destroying water systems, and enriching what he calls the poison cartel. So, he says, in a note to my fellow environmental leaders, Bill Gates is not our amigo. And this is almost funny in context. It's largely Bill Gates' doing, he says, that half of America sees climate change as either a great reset flim-flam to shift wealth upward, which is pretty much true, or a geoengineering boondoggle, which is also pretty much true. But, says RFK Jr., it's on them that they don't recognize the serious peril of climate change, but it's on us that we're deliberately blinded to the peril of Bill Gates. Now, here's the problem, folks. No doubt about it, the climate is changing. The doubt has to do with whether or not it's man-made in the sense of you're driving your SUV causing the problem because of your carbon footprint and similar pseudoscientific BS. So if you drive an electric car instead, that actually ends up producing more carbon, but it's just not obvious to the idiots. You can still virtue signal like you're actually doing something. What irritates your host, though, is when so-called scientists, bought and paid for by Big Brother, ignore trivial things like the impact of the sun on a planet's climate. Still, though, and I agree with RFK Jr. on this, Gates profits from all this confusion. The polarization of the climate debate paralyzes reform efforts, thereby preserving the value of his carbon stakes. Research and long experience have shown that agroecology based on biodiversity, what he calls seed freedom and food freedom, is essential not just to what he calls civil liberties and democracy, but the future of food and farming. He quotes a 2009 study from the United Nations by the International Assessment of Agricultural Knowledge, Science, and Technology for Development, IAASTD, and the incontrovertible evidence demonstrating the abject failure of the Bill Gates Rockefeller Green Revolution to improve on what he calls traditional agriculture. They deployed a team of 900 leading scientists, agronomists, and researchers to study world hunger, and their definitive report showed that GMO crops, I hope you're sitting down, are not the answer to food shortfalls or rural poverty. In fact, their analysis demonstrates that what the Rockefeller Foundation launched in India and Mexico in the 1960s as a green revolution was a catastrophe, destroying biodiversity, soil, and water, as well as contributing to climate change. Green Revolution policies, he says, subvert food and nutritional security and dispossess small farmers through debt, meaning that seed sovereignty, food sovereignty, and knowledge sovereignty are the only real viable future for food and farming. And furthermore, the UN's top agricultural scientists have admitted that GMOs cannot fight hunger as well as traditional farming. But Bill Gates has opted to ignore this reality because, as Gates MD seems to put it, good health only comes in a syringe. Yep, he is the world's biggest vaccine producer as well. So, Farmer Bill preaches good food only comes from monocultures, chemical pesticides, fertilizers, GMO crops, and patented seeds that he just happens to own. And that's where RFK Jr. goes next, because he's noted that through vigorous, ingenious genetics, things farmers have been doing for thousands of years, we now have a miraculous collaboration between humans, nature, and their creator that's resulted in immense agricultural innovation, where the free exchange of knowledge and seeds among farmers has been the basis for maintaining biodiversity and food security for a long, long time. Since 1979, though, under World Bank auspices, a consortium of agricultural research centers known as the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research, I'm going to pronounce it CIGAR, C-G-I-A-R, have been collecting seeds from small farmers across the globe and preserving them in what were at least once 15 independent public seed banks in different countries. The venture sought to achieve a complete inventory of heritage seed stocks around the world for the benefit of humanity and to preserve crop diversity for, well, millennia. But for the last 17 years, Gates has successfully maneuvered to gain control of these collections. Who could have thought it? And assert monopoly ownership not only over the world's premier seed inventories, but ultimately, as he's going to point out, their very genome. Beginning in 2003, working in coordination with the Rockefeller Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation pumped $750 million into the CIGAR Seed Bank project, and as the largest funder, Gates used his financial leverage to force the merger of those once legally independent centers into one legal entity in a sinister initiative that he now calls Gates Ag One. Whereupon he transferred the research and seeds from scientific research institutions to commodity-based corporations like Bayer and Cargill, with which he partners. In the process, plundering, raiding, and privatizing the seed stockpile for the most promising seeds from indigenous farmers around the world. He goes into some of the details about the players here and the way that they've done this, but the bottom line is he is using things like CRISPR technology to bolster his patent portfolio, selectively edit the heritage seed genomes, and make changes sufficient to withstand patent challenges. Yeah, folks, it's all about taking control, literally, of the world's seeds and their genome. Principal objective of which, says RFK Jr., is to breed green revolution varieties engineered to respond to chemical inputs produced by Gates' poison cartel partners, Monsanto, Bayer, Dow, DuPont, CropLife, BASF, Syngenta, and so on. In the process, Gates deliberately robs the seed of its integrity and diversity, erasing evolutionary history and its links to the soil, and reducing it all to a simple code, in which way he manages to capture our planet's genetic diversity, rewrite it, patent its code, steal the seeds from humanity, and then marry them off to the chemical conglomerates. And by centralizing the seed banks and manipulating intellectual property laws, Gates has launched a campaign that RFK Jr. calls genetic colonialism to rob the world's peasants and indigenous farmers of their seeds and knowledge. He quotes agricultural freedom activist Dr. Vandana Shiva, who says Gates' Ag One aim is to take control over the genetic diversity of our planet. Gates Ag One is a declaration of his intent to create an empire over food, farming, and literally our sustenance. In the process, Gates, he said, is financing infernal Frankenstein experiments that defile God's creation. And by conning government officials, manipulating intellectual property law, and rewriting seed regulations, says RFK Jr., Gates has been able to bypass or trample these statutes and various treaties, evade the multilateral governance structures that governments put in place to prevent big corporations from hijacking what supposedly these laws were supposed to prevent them from hijacking, which your host notes here shows the problem. Big law inevitably gets corrupted by big money, which is pretty much one and the same with Big Brother, at least when it comes to a fascist public-private partnership. All of this, says the author, explains Gates' obsessive promotion of GMOs. GMO vaccines and medicines are mainstays of his public health enterprise. He finances research, development, and proliferation of GMOs as the fix for every agricultural problem, too. He gives example after example, including, of course, Gates' stake in Monsanto, one of the world's most aggressive promoters of GMOs and pesticides. The central mission of Gates Ag 1, says RFK Jr., is to fly into the face of virtually every independent science and safety assessment in a blind rush to impose Gates' untested GMOs, patented seeds, synthetic foods, and experimental medicines on humanity. He talks about Gates buying off big media, too, saying one might expect his Monsanto stake and partnerships with processed food, chemical, oil companies to discredit his pretensions as a so-called public health advocate, but his massive investments in big media shows how the crooked game is played. A Nation magazine expose in March of last year exposed the Gates Foundation bought him favorable coverage with $250 million in grants to media outlets, including NBC, Universal, the BBC, NPR, The Guardian, Le Monde, Al Jazeera, and lots of other influential waste stream media outlets that have insulated him from the scrutiny and skepticism that the media, well, once upon a time, historically applied to fiendish profiteering schemes and rank hypocrisy by power-mad billionaires. His wealth and power also enable him to evade government efforts to regulate GMO proliferation. He's deployed his billions to orchestrate attacks against GMO and gene editing laws in many of the countries that have tried to impose safety standards, including something with the potential to be really nasty called gene drives. In 2017, a German human rights group, Heinrich Böll Stiftung, or HBS, published evidence of a Gates secretive campaign to evade democratically imposed restraints on high-risk gene manipulation experiments, including this diabolical new technology that's called the gene drive, which are at the cutting edge of genetic engineering, synthetic biology, and gene editing, and also are the tools of choice for eugenicists and those seeking to build the technocratic transhuman future championed by Gates and his other Silicon Valley cronies. The idea is that scientists use CRISPR technology to edit genes into an organism's chromosomes and reprogram its DNA to switch off the normal rules of genetic inheritance and drive the artificially induced trait that they want through an entire population, spreading it to all future generations. This capacity to permanently alter the genome of an entire species makes gene drives the biological instrument of ultimate power. Gene editing technology, says the author, could facilitate Gates' schemes to create and patent, of course, new and improved species of plants and animals, or exterminate species of which he disapproves. Think about that one. One of his aims is to use gene drives to insert suicide genes, as they're called, and eradicate entire species, say, of a mosquito that might spread Zika or malaria, a goal of the Target Malaria Project, in which Gates has invested $40 million, and, of course, none other than America's Dr. Mengele, Anthony Fauci, longtime protege and partner of Gates, and an enthusiastic cheerleader for gene drives, told Stat News, quote, getting rid of them would be a blessing. Is he talking about deplorables? Anyway, critics argue that gene drives pose an existential biosecurity risk to all of humanity due to their capacity to change or eliminate entire species and to catastrophically alter ecosystems. They're also the ultimate biological weapon, hey, you knew that was coming, didn't you, that the most satanic minds in various military and intelligence agencies covet in order to breed things like super soldiers or mint apocalypse genes. Critics, of course, fear that nations might one day use the suicide genes or genocide genes to eradicate entire races that they think might have undesirable traits. Nowadays, I guess that means like whiteness or the ability to read the Constitution for comprehension. Well, you have to ask the question, folks, what could possibly go wrong or, in their minds, right? And I think the implications here are clear. HBS's file on gene drives exposes the leading role of the U.S. military's DARPA in the development of gene drive technology. They spent about $100 million researching gene drives. And the other primary drivers, of course, are Dr. Fauci's National Institutes of Health and what else? The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has invested $75 million in suicide and anti-fertility genes. Think about that when they try to get you to take the poke. Meanwhile, says RFK Jr., environmentalists worry about unintended consequences if suicide or extinction genes manage to leap species. RFK Jr. devotes several paragraphs to Bill Gates' investments in things like synthetic meat, which he calls the future of food, whether you like it or not. Things like Beyond Meat, which make plant-based GMO and pesticide-laden chicken tacos. Impossible Foods, there's a great moniker, which produces synthetic burgers and brats from GMO'd soy.
and Memphis Meats, which formulates its concoction on a substrate of calf's blood. There's even a South African company that makes edible protein from cultivated maggots. Oh, yeah. All of which leads right to the World Economic Forum, the Global Reset, and something called the EAT Forum, a.k.a. Davos for Food, which is strategically linked to GlaxoSmithKline and partners with others, including Bayer, Cargill, Syngenta, Unilever, and tech giant Gulag, in an effort to transform the food system. Others suggest it's really about patenting lab-processed fake food in a massive corporate takeover. Your host will simply suggest the Bible talks about it more than once. Places like Leviticus 26:26 and Isaiah 9:20, where the warning over and over again has to do with people who eat but are not satisfied.